winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program. This is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. My partner, Matt Ryan, is off this week, but I am not alone because we are starting at the Reporters' Roundtable with Yancey Roy from Newsday and Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio. Well, yet again, we have had a busy week in what is supposed to be a quiet August. And it started off last Sunday with a very surprising statement from Senate Majority Leader John Flanagan that he had sought help for what he described as an alcohol problem. A quote from his statement: "Recently, I recognized that alcohol was becoming a crutch to deal with pressure. I was underrelated to my responsibilities as Majority Leader of the State Senate." And this was prompted by initial inquiries from Newsday, specifically from you, Yancey Roy.
Well, we had gotten information about that the senator had decided to seek out help in what he called alcohol dependency and sought to contact them about that. That ended up prompting his statement. I think that it was surprising to a lot of people. I know that we subsequently talked to a number of senators, most of whom were completely caught off guard by this. I think that the number of folks who had been informed about it were kept relatively small. And I think that it also sort of a sign of the times now that when he made the statement, mostly what you heard was signs of support. Mm-hmm. This is courageous for someone to come out and admit this, to seek support and acknowledge that they were dealing with something. Certainly a different reaction than what we might have seen decades ago.
Yeah, well, it's no longer considered a moral failing. People know it's a disease. It's often genetic. And I think a lot of people are giving him credit for coming clean. I mean, it seems like he wanted to maybe keep his private life quiet until you started inquiring about it. But to come clean and say, look, this is a problem I had, and I'm seeking help. And I think, you know, he deserves credit for seeking help for it instead of letting it fester.
And there's no sign, at least that I can see, that it potentially might imperil Flanagan's leadership at all.
I don't think so. In this day and age, I don't think that people are going to blame him for that. I think it's more a lot of other factors that are going on, though. I think actually it's up to Governor Cuomo. If Governor Cuomo still wants the Senate Republicans in, they will, because he's been supportive of the Independent Democratic Conference, those breakaway Democrats who've often joined with the Senate Republicans to form a leadership coalition. So at this point, it seems like the Senate Republicans, they're more dependent on Cuomo because demographics are changing. There's fewer Republicans in the state, and they are just barely hanging on. I mean, they only have 31 members. We won't get into all of that. They don't even have a numerical majority right now.
Hold that thought.
Yes.
And there was an internal struggle 2 years ago when Dean Skelos was forced out after being indicted. There was an internal struggle between John Flanagan of Long Island and John DeFrancisco of Syracuse, and a very narrow vote that Flanagan won. So there's always this underlying tension within the conference. And at the same time, they know because they don't have a vote to spare, they usually try to keep any internal differences internal and present a united front on most all pieces of legislation.
It was kind of a reminder that Albany kind of has a unique and often sometimes very alcohol-driven culture. It's a bit like being at college in the sense that you have nights kind of all to yourself sometimes, or you're attending a fundraiser, which is usually open bar. So,
well, yeah, they're kind of like they're all single when they're in Albany because you don't have your family there and, you know, you have those hours to fill, I guess. I don't do that anymore. I'm way past that part of my life, so this is only hearsay for me.
Yeah. Well, let's move on, but let's stay with the Senate. Still within the bucket of Senate turmoil, we have news this week, a somewhat surprising announcement on Wednesday morning that Senator Daniel Squadron, who was first elected in 2008, Democrat, mainline Democrat from Brooklyn, is going to be leaving the Senate this week on Friday, I think it becomes effective.
Yeah, very rare exit of a lawmaker without a felony conviction or an arrest or an indictment or saying that he wants to, quote, spend more time with his family. It seems like he was just fed up with being in the minority in the Senate Democrats. And, you know, I don't know him well, but I got that sense from him in recent years that he just was kind of frustrated that he wasn't getting ahead more in the job. And it does seem like he, you know, really wants to do something else with his life.
Well, remember, he also ran for New York City Advocate at one point. Mm-hmm. So it was clear that he was looking beyond the state Senate.
And he wasn't
successful. I think in his subsequent statements after the announcement, it was clear that part of feeling like the Democrats weren't getting enough done or were stymied in trying to get things done because of the brokered Senate right now, that was part of his frustration and feeling that he could do more in another position.
It's not going to change the makeup of the Senate because that's a solid Democratic seat. So another
right.
Democrat will get that
right.
seat.
And it's going to be another mainline Democrat as well.
Probably. Who knows?
That announcement was made the same day that Shane Goldmacher in the New York Times reported a little bit more on the previously reported meeting that Governor Cuomo and mainline Democrats had about 2 weeks ago. And Goldmacher reported that that Governor Cuomo sort of what I will refer to as gov-splained to mainline Democratic leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins that, you know what, you guys, meaning mainline Democrats, don't really seem to understand the suburbs that well. And maybe Jeff Klein, leader of the Independent Democratic Conference in the Senate, they seem to understand the suburbs a little bit better, which brought a stinging retort from Andrea Stewart-Cousins where she said, hey, Governor, you see me and you might see a black woman, but what you don't seem to recognize is that I represent Westchester County, which is the burbs.
She was actually essentially saying, according to the report, you don't see me. You look at me, but you don't see me. And you're telling me that a white man knows more about the suburbs than I do when I represent the suburbs, too. And it just shows the festering tensions. I mean, she's the first woman legislative leader. She's a black woman. And I know it's rankled a lot of people, including her, that for years they have these leaders meetings to decide the budget and the end of the session. And it's always men in the room. And she's standing outside. And I know that that's bothered her and bothered many people at the Capitol. And you could see that kind of tensions coming, if these, you know, accounts are true, the tensions coming to a head there.
And also the political divide, what with the breakaway Democrats, the Independent Democratic Conference led by Jeff Klein. There's been a lot of dissatisfaction among mainline Democrats that they haven't partnered with the mainline Democrats or that Governor Cuomo hasn't leaned in and forced them to come back to the fold.
And the question is, could Governor Cuomo force them to go, this kind of marriage to get back together? I don't know if he can at this point because there's bitter, bitter feelings between those two conferences. Maybe at one point he could have several years ago, but I'm wondering if he could even do that at this point.
Speaking of bitterness, that Shane Goldmacher story was posted on Facebook by Daniel Loeb, who is a wealthy hedge fund guy, a major contributor to both charter school causes and to Governor Andrew Cuomo, as well as lots of Republicans. And Loeb posted that story with a comment calling Andrew Stewart-Cousins a hypocrite and saying that she has done, and I quote here, more damage to people of color than anyone who has ever donned a hood, in reference to what he alleged was her lack of support for charter schools. Incendiary comments, which were reported by the aforementioned Mr. Goldmacher in the New York Times, caused a Thursday night firestorm. Loeb apologized and took those comments down, but boy, oh boy.
Yeah, I just feel like in this political atmosphere, like people will say anything these days. You know, what's going on with Washington, with President Trump and Congress, it's just kind of shocking.
You know, as someone who was born and raised in the South, I have to say that those kind of comments just show a sort of a profound ignorance or just maybe not thinking it through as to what it means when you say, make a Ku Klux Klan reference at people who donned hoods, who murdered people in the South, who were trying to fight for civil rights. I don't know. I don't know where that comment came from, but it was really profoundly ignorant.
It's just like the most horrible thing you could say to a black person, frankly. So are there repercussions for Governor Cuomo on this, since this guy is a big donor of his? I don't know. That's up, I guess, to his political opponents to try to make a connection there. Obviously, Governor Cuomo's spokesman said, look, we have nothing to do
right.
with this. We're this has nothing to do with us.
Yeah. Moving along to other potential trouble for Governor Cuomo, Cynthia Nixon, the actress and activist, especially on LGBT rights and education issues, has been floated as a potential Democratic primary opponent for the governor next year. She has done, I think, a couple of interviews where she did not shoot down the idea that she might run for governor.
Yeah, and the Today Show, where she said, well, certainly a lot of people are talking about it, and I care about education issues. It's got to make Governor Cuomo nervous because she's popular with New York City Democrats, which are his base, and he's having a little trouble with that base now because the MTA and the subway system and the transit system's falling apart and people are blaming him for it. So it's got to make him a little nervous that she's out there.
You know, we're still in the summer of 17, so it's a little far out.
Yeah.
And it's, so it's hard to judge right now how serious any of these talks are. There's also been Terry Gibson, the former senator. There's also been Stephanie Miner, the Syracuse mayor. How much of this is building up to maybe be a serious challenge, or is it kind of what we'd call saber rattling from the left to try to push the governor to take more progressive positions on what they feel, education and some other issues?
I thought their response was interesting too, because usually they personally insult anybody who's against them, but they were kind of saying, why don't you come in and, you know, we'll talk to you about education. I thought it was a little bit patronizing. Maybe it was back to Casey's point, they're gonna govsplain education to her. They're like, we need to clarify some facts with you, but we welcome the debate. So that makes me think that they're a little worried about her.
All right, well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. So thanks very much to Yancey Roy from Newsday and Karen DeWitt. Stick around, because in times of great unrest around the nation and the world, or at any other time, it's worthwhile to sit down with the state's top financial watchdog, state controller Tom DiNapoli. Karen did just that earlier this week.
Controller Tom DiNapoli, thanks for being on our show again. We're glad to have you.
Great to be back, Karen. Thank you.
So I wanted to start off talking about state finances. There's some troublesome signs out there right now. And in your monthly reports, you're finding that state revenues are down. What do you attribute that to?
Well, you know, let's look at it in a broader context. We do a monthly cash report, we call it, to really keep track of how the state is doing in terms of revenues versus expenditures versus projections. You know, now that the budget is in place. And you're right, we found that revenues are off by about $1.2 billion compared to last year in our June report. When you compare to projections, it's not quite as dramatic an impact. It's about $315 million less. You know, what to attribute that to? You know, some might argue that there is somewhat of a slowdown in parts of the economy. That might be part of it. I think perhaps a more appropriate explanation is that for many higher income New Yorkers, everybody's still waiting to see what's going to happen with the federal tax proposals, none of which have really been, you know, tax reform hasn't happened yet.
Well, that's what I was wondering about. Are wealthier people hanging on to their investments, saying maybe I'm not going to have to pay this, you know, what I consider to be a high capital gains rate?
Yeah.
Let's see what happens with tax reform. That means the money's there, they're just holding back.
They're holding on to it because they're hoping for more favorable tax treatment. I think that might be a more appropriate explanation. June is a key month because that's you know, the first quarter, so you do get, you know, important tax payments. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's not so much a red light of alarm, but more a yellow cautionary light that, you know, in the context of the size of the New York State budget being off by $315 million in June is not a huge deviation. But, you know, it's certainly not in the direction we'd like it to be in. I think it just means we need to carefully monitor our revenues and expenditures. And it certainly emphasizes on the point we just talked about with federal tax reform that what's happening in Washington is probably the greatest risk to where we stand.
Absolutely. That's the federal kind of very scary scenarios, at least for New York State's finances. You know, the attempts to repeal and replace Obamacare would cost the state billions of dollars in funding. And then if they do make these tax changes and you can't deduct your local and state taxes, that's a big hit for a state like New York. So keep you up at night?
Yeah. Well, New York has a significant amount of tax of state and local. And it's like $67 billion in those
deductions.
Yeah, because
we have high, you know, property taxes and local taxes, and people have been able to deduct that. If they can't, that's
a hit. The argument the other way is that if they significantly increase the standard deduction for most middle-class working families, it won't be an impact. It may even be a net gain. But that's part of the problem in analyzing what's going on in Washington. Everything is really like an outline, and there's not a whole lot of specifics.
Yeah.
And you know, I think the experience always is that, you know, if they say, trust us, it's not going to hurt the middle class, well, the opposite happens. And in fact, many of these proposals seem to be geared more to helping the wealthy rather than the middle class. The middle class, you know, not just in New York, but all across the country, is very much under threat and feeling very vulnerable with everything going on. I think it's part of what was expressed in the election last year. But I suspect that when you look at the changes in federal tax reform that are being proposed, the cuts in federal budget and the impact that would have on state and local governments. And you mentioned the changes in health care. I don't think that's what the middle class voters who voted, you know, for the change in Washington, I don't think that's what they were looking for. And you're right. I mean, New York has leveraged billions of dollars under the current structure on health care. And just, you know, over 2 million New Yorkers would lose coverage if Obamacare is repealed. And what will that mean, Karen? That'll mean that people will revert to using the emergency room at the hospital as their doctor's office. They'll show up later and sicker, costing more money. Yeah. And if they can't pay, the rest of us pay through our
everybody's premiums
or through charity pools, you know, and taxpayer money. So a lot of these proposals, you know, long term would really have a very negative impact on the quality of life in New York and on the finances of New York as well.
And there's a lot of worry, but so far nothing's happened. I mean, do you think that, should be complacent about it?
You asked earlier about staying up at night, right? So during some of the Affordable Care Act, you know, repeal and replace and all that stuff debate, I was staying up a little late, you know, watching CNN and getting very concerned. But then you realized, you know, they can't get their own act together and they have divisions on their own side. You know, but it is, isn't it a sad commentary that inaction or disarray among the Republicans is what our best hope for is right now for things to be okay? That's really not how it should be.
Or maybe they'll take the next step and work together to fix Obamacare. Well, I mean, there's always a hope,
right? But that's an interesting
point.
Yeah. I mean, because I think that's what the public's looking for, you know, and John McCain, when he gave that speech, which really was his message, that there's really a bigger purpose for us being here that we're missing, I think that was a very statesmanlike call. I'm not sure that it's been responded to at this point, but it really does require people getting out of this gridlock and these partisan positions. But I think until the Republicans have a more clear sense of where they're headed, I mean, the Democrats, surprisingly, are sticking together in Washington. Usually, Democrats are the ones that are fighting
each other. That's right. Certainly New York State, that's happening. New York State Senate.
So it's very, I mean, I give Chuck Schumer credit as Senate minority leader, in keeping his Democrats united. I think that's been quite, and in the House as well. I think that says something about how strongly the Democratic Party feels about some of what they're trying to impose on the country.
Now, back to the state's finances for a minute. You've sort of gamed out the out-year budget gaps, saying that it could be $17.4 billion dollars in
3 years?
3 years, that's if spending goes on.
Yeah.
I have to say, I've been here a long time, and so have you. I feel like I've seen this movie before.
Yeah.
The out-year budget gaps start growing. You also mentioned that the bank settlements, that windfall we've been getting, some of that's been using for operating expenses to sort of prop up spending. It just seems like we're heading for another budget crisis or potentially in the next couple of years.
We could, and that's why, you know, your earlier questions about where is the economy at and what's happening in Washington, how will it impact us, those are important questions. But you're also pointing out the fact that New York is a state that does spend a lot of money. Many important commitments have been made as part of the current budget, you know, and if the current spending patterns continue, we could have some real issues, especially if the economy slows down and revenues slow and if we get hurt by Washington. You know, part of what helps this current budget and certainly next year is the fact that they extended the surcharge on our upper-income New Yorkers.
That's
and,
true.
And that
so-called millionaire's tax.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that helps us, you know, for now. But we just see the gaps as being more significant as we move to the out years. So again, it means having to look carefully about the big macro trends, but I also think it means for the legislature and the governor coming back next year, having to be a bit more conservative in terms of how we're viewing spending. I mean, a lot of worthy programs that people care a great deal about, and I know next year is an election year, right?
Yeah, so, which adds to the pressure. Yeah. You don't want to do anything that might offend, you know, your potential voters.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're going to have to balance a lot. Let's hope that the economy, you know, will continue in the positive direction, but pick up. You know, we depend a lot on New York City's strength, and New York City is still growing jobs, but at a slower pace. You know, that's part of the issue there. You got big debates going on now about MTA and how to you know finance that, and you saw the mayor of New York City proposed another surcharge on upper-income New Yorkers. So
you got to get some revenue in because it's falling apart.
So you got to factor in big-ticket items like that. So I think 2018 is going to be an interesting budget cycle. And that's in that sense, you're right. We have seen that picture before.
That's right. But there is some good news here, right? You released your pension fund report, and the pension fund is up. Tell us about that.
We do quarterly reporting. We try to give people as much information as possible. We ended the fiscal year March 31st in a very strong position, about 11.5% positive return, $192 billion value. Mm-hmm. Now we have our first quarter numbers in. For the quarter, just for the quarter, 2.9% positive return. We're up to now an estimated $197 billion. So,
how does 2.9% compare to other pension funds? Is that higher, well, average?
It's been a good cycle. So it's just for the quarter. So you'd have to, if assuming that would keep up, you multiply it, by four quarters. So it's comparable. I mean, all pension funds are benefiting from the fact that a great deal of our money is invested in public equities in the stock market, domestic stocks particularly. The stock market rally continues. It's been going on longer than most people would have ever projected, right, but we're benefiting from that right now.
And certainly as we speak, it's going on, though there seems to be some worry starting about North Korea. I'm wondering, that really does help President Trump. I know you're a Democrat, not a big fan of President Trump. It seems like a lot of people who aren't paying attention to all the nitty-gritty in Washington, they're pretty complacent as long as the stock market is doing well and, the economy isn't completely horrible. I'm wondering if that, it's helping the pension fund, but it kind of does help the president, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, it's an odd situation, though, because you remember election night, the futures cratered. I mean, 800-900 points down.
That's right, yeah. And there's a lot of worry.
And then everything settled out. I do believe that part of what's happening is a benefit of the economy that President Obama left us. So, who's ever in office at a given time takes credit or gets blame, even if it wasn't totally their fault,
yeah,
or to their credit. So I think part of it is the continuation of the positive economy we had towards the end of the Obama presidency. But there's a lot about the stock market that's more psychological than anything else. And I would have to say that it seems that some of the talk about the business climate, whether in reality it's better or not, seems to be benefiting there. But to the extent that it is psychological, world events, certainly North Korea as a flashpoint being one of them, that could set everything going in the opposite direction. It hasn't yet. I think the concern I have is that this rally has been going on even pre-President Trump, for a longer period than most rallies. So at some point there'll be a correction. One would hope it will not be what we went through, in 08, 09, where it really was a crash, and I don't think anybody's projecting that. But, as long as interest rates are as low as they are, other world economies are in a strong, the safest place to put money is in the U.S., and the place to make money now is not by leaving it in a bank CD, but by putting it in the stock market. So, and I do have to say we've also, because of our diversification, our real estate is doing well. Our private equity is doing well. So,
It's not just in stock.
But because of the limitations on where we could put our money, a great deal is in stocks, and most of that is in U.S. So when the U.S. stock market is up, we do benefit. And of course, when it's up, everybody says, "Why don't you have all your money in stocks?" And then when it goes down, everybody says, "Why'd you put so much money in stocks and taking all that risk?" So what we do as a pension fund and a large institutional investor, we're very patient. We have an asset allocation we believe in. It's diversified as much as we can, and we're in it for the long haul. So sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down, but I am confident that it's going to continue to move in the right direction. We can keep our promise to our public retirees and our public workers, and I'm hoping because of good returns we might be able to, not dramatically, but continue to reduce the contribution rate that will benefit local governments and taxpayers. So then we'll know that in a few more weeks. But certainly having a good year last year, a good first quarter this year, we're off to a good start to hopefully have another good year in pension fund return.
Okay, final question. You mentioned that 2018's election year. Are you going to run for re-election as controller?
That's my plan. The secret, and I don't want you to tell anybody, is that I got the best job in state government, so I certainly want to continue to stay a state controller.
No desire to run for governor? I know your name has been mentioned at times.
Well, it's always flattering when your name gets mentioned, but, I do love this job, and that's certainly my plan. So I have no plans to make plans other than running for re-election.
All right. Well, thanks very much for giving us the time.
Thanks, Karen.
This week's New York Now poll question is, should Governor Andrew Cuomo take a more active role in unifying the state Senate's Democrats? Let us know what you think on our website, nynow.org. Last week, we asked, has Eric Schneiderman been an effective attorney general for the state of New York? And 72% said yes. Jim in Gansevoort said, Mr. Schneiderman is part of New York's grand tradition of strong AGs. back to Lewis Lefkowitz in 1957. He is doing a superb job of protecting us on so many fronts. John in the Tioga County town of Cander, watching on WSKG, said Schneiderman has been an activist AG pushing an agenda, obviously not concerned about the law. Ruth in Bainbridge, also in the Southern Tier, said AG Schneiderman, upon learning a large drug company was preventing a generic drug being made available to New York citizens, sued the company and won. He has saved my family thousands of dollars a year. Thanks to all those who voted. You can vote at nynow.org. While you're there, you can view any of our past programs over the years and follow links to us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where our handle is at nynow_PBS. Make sure to check out my paper's Capital Confidential blog while you're there. It can also be found at timesunion.com. All right, well, we leave you today with footage of Southern Lake Champlain by the Crown Point Bridge. I'm Casey Seiler of the Times Union. Thanks for watching.